On Sunday night, we have been exploring, I guess is the best word, Genesis chapters 1 through 11, which is, as I have mentioned many times, those chapters are the foundation for the rest of the Bible. You take away their trustworthiness, you take away their truth, the rest of the Bible is suspect. So therefore, knowing what these first 11 chapters teach and why they are true is foundational to our beliefs. Jesus believed them. The apostles believed them. They both taught that they were true. In these first 11 chapters, we're introduced to the beginning of a number of different things. We saw the beginning of the world. We saw the beginning of life, plant life and animal life and human life. We saw the beginning of Adam and Eve getting their souls. We saw the beginning of sin. We saw the beginning of families. We saw, of course, the life of Noah and what he represented and all that he did. And we have looked at the flood on a number of Sundays and the significance of the flood and how the flood changed the world in a number of ways. Chapter 9, which we looked at a long time ago, the last time we had Sunday evening, we looked at the law of the of eye for an eye, where we were told, or they were told, about the life is in the blood, and if someone sheds innocent blood, then his blood is to be shed. And we talked about the significance and the relevance of that at the beginning of Genesis chapter 9. And that brings us down to some other beginnings. From the middle of Genesis chapter 9 through the end of Genesis chapter 11, we see the dispersal of mankind after the flood. And that has tremendous significance even to today, because we see the beginning of various ethnic groups, various nations, the beginning of various languages, and so all of these things that are so important to civilization today and society today have their beginnings there in Genesis 9 through 11. So understanding them is very important for us today, especially when most of America, or at least a lot of people in America, even religious people, don't believe in the truth of Genesis 1 through 11. So it's very, very important. It's imperative that we understand and believe and teach the truth of those first 11 chapters. This evening, we're going to look at the last half of Genesis chapter 9, which tells us about the covenant of the rainbow and its significance, which of course is still lasting, as well as what happens to Noah and his three sons. And so both of those we're going to look at tonight in the last half of Genesis chapter 9. So please open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 9, and we're going to begin there in verse 8. Genesis chapter 9, beginning in verse 8. And let's see how he begins this section. Genesis chapter 9, verses 8 and 9 says this: Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you. Of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Here we have the beginning of this covenant. A covenant is an agreement. It's a contract, if you will. Here it's between God and man. Now, in no way is man on the level with God, as important with God or as powerful as God, but God, if you will, condescended to make an agreement, a covenant, a contract with man. And this is right after the flood. So Noah, his three sons, their wives, and Noah's wife has experienced the destruction of the world. They come out of the ark and see a world that has been completely transformed from what it was before. So they are entering a brave new world, very, very different in most all aspects than what they saw. And so God says, I'm going to make a covenant with you. There's two basic types of covenants. There are covenants that come with conditions attached. God will say, I will do this if, and of course that's what most of the covenants he made with the Israelites were about. You know, if they were faithful, or if they followed his commands, or if they were obedient. This is an unconditional covenant. This has nothing to do with what man will or will not do. This is an unconditional covenant. God said he was going to do something. He promised he would do something, period. No conditions attached to it whatsoever. And he says this covenant is with you and your descendants. So this covenant was going to be with Noah and his descendants and every generation after that until the world ended. Every generation. And he says this would also pertain to all these living creatures. Like he says, birds and cattle and so forth. All of them that went out of the ark. He said, I'm going to make this. This is going to be worldwide in scope. Verse 11, thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again, this is his promise, never again all flesh cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Now, I want to stop there because that one verse has huge significance. We can read that verse and maybe kind of pass over it and say, okay, God made a covenant and go on. But that verse, when we look at its implications, is huge. That verse is huge. Here's why. He says, I'm going to promise something. Here's the promise. No conditions attached. The promise is, I will never, ever do what I've just done. That's the promise. I'll never do it. I will never destroy the earth again with a flood. Now, what is so relevant about that to us? Well, because so many people say the flood was just a little local flood there in Mesopotamia. Have we had any local floods since then? Thousands and thousands and thousands. So either God was a liar and didn't keep his promise, or the flood of Noah's day was truly universal. See, that is the significance of that verse. Either God's a liar, didn't keep his promise, and had lots and lots and lots of floods like Noah, or the flood of Noah's day was truly unique. Jesus believed it was unique. The apostles believed it was unique. Peter, as we'll read in a minute in 2 Peter chapter 3, thought it was unique. So the Bible teaches it was unique. It wasn't a local flood. It didn't just cover part of the earth. It covered the entire earth. That's the significance of that one verse. It was a global, worldwide, universal flood. Covered every square inch of the earth. There was not a tiny part of the earth that was not underwater. That's what that verse teaches. So we either believe the Bible or we believe that God didn't keep his promise. Those are our choices. In verse 12 he says, let me look at one other thing before we go to verse 12, and that's found in Isaiah chapter 54. Of course, that's written a long, long time after the events of Genesis 9. In Isaiah 54, the prophet by inspiration said this. Notice these two verses in 9 and 10. Isaiah 54, verses 9 and 10, have a lot of significance with Genesis 9. This is what those two verses say. For this is like the waters of Noah to me. For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah would no longer cover the earth, so I have sworn that I would not be angry with you nor rebuke you. For the mountains shall depart and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from you, nor shall my covenant of peace be removed. Lord, who has mercy on you. See, he goes back, the prophet does, of course it's God speaking through the prophet, goes all the way back to the days of Noah and talks about that covenant that he made. And of course, that was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later that Isaiah would write. Isaiah wrote like 700 and some years before the time of Christ. So it was a long time after. So going back to Genesis 9 and seeing its significance. Now in verses 12 and 13, he says, "And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and you, every living creature of all flesh. The water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be a cloud to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that's on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." So God makes the covenant, and now he says, this is the what? This is the sign of the covenant. Some translations have, this is the token of the covenant. Every time they would see a rainbow in the sky, for generations and generations, through the end of time, that rainbow was a sign to all humanity that God's promise that he would never, ever destroy the earth with a flood again was to be counted on. God was never going to go back on his promise. And every time they saw that rainbow, that was a sign of that. That was a reminder. Not that God needed reminding, but men needed reminding. So that was the sign. Often covenants had different types of signs. Agreements had different types of signs. Well, the sign for this covenant was one, and it was a rainbow. And of course, how significant that is, because of course a rainbow is formed when light shines through water droplets. So when do you see a rainbow? Well, when there's water. So how appropriate that sign would be that God chose for them to be reminded that he would never go back on that promise. So Noah and the rest of his family, when they're outside the ark, there is no reason for them to be afraid that, oh, well, we might have to go back on the ark. He may send another flood. No, God is telling them, I'll never, ever do that again. There will never be a need for another Noah to build another ark. Because God said, I'm never going to send a flood like that again. And we can count on that. You know, that's what he said he would do. And so that's what happens. But men need reminders. Well, in 2 Peter chapter 3, I said I was going to go there in a minute. Now's the time to go. 2 Peter chapter 3. Let's begin in verse 1. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 1 says this. Beloved, I now write to you this second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust and saying, where's the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. That's what many people in the world teach, that everything that's going on today has been exactly like it's been going on since the beginning of the world. There's been no global catastrophes. There's been no global anything. It's often called uniformitarianism. But it's the idea that everything has always been uniform. Well, that's what Peter says. These people don't know the truth. Because, verse 5, for this they willfully forget. It's not done in ignorance. He says, this they willfully forget. They don't even believe it. That by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. Peter says, things have not always been the same. Things that are going on today didn't necessarily go on in the past. Things are different because at one time, God destroyed the world by water. That event completely changed everything. That's what Peter says. And Peter says people, even in the first century, were forgetting this. But they were willfully forgetting. It wasn't due to ignorance. They were willfully forgetting it. Things have not always been going on the same. And one of those that completely changed everything was the flood in Noah's day. Verse 7 of 2 Peter 3, "But the heavens and the earth which are now preserved by the same word are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." And of course the rest of the chapter talks about the fact that that's going to happen. No, he's not going to destroy the world ever again by water. But the next time, the destruction will be total and final and complete. And he says that time it's going to be done by fire. He's not going to remake the earth or reshape the earth or cleanse the earth. He's going to completely annihilate the earth. So that there will be no earth left. There will be no moon left, no stars left, no planets, no galaxies, nothing. You and I can't imagine that because you and I don't have that kind of power. You and I don't have the power to annihilate anything. He can annihilate anything he wants. He can make anything he wants out of nothing. He can take something that exists and annihilate it where there's nothing left. So you and I simply don't have that power. Not in any way, shape, or form. So people, since the beginning of time, have neglected that God can do and move like he has in the past. Like in the days of the flood. And people completely ignore that today. Things don't always continue as they have from the beginning. That's what scoffers, unbelievers. Unfortunately, there are vast numbers of religious people that teach the same thing. And of course, that's the saddest part. But Peter says, and he calls them scoffers. So, God said, that's the sign. And remember, never ever again will I destroy the earth with water. I am going to destroy the earth, but it's going to be with fire. And that destruction will far surpass what happened in the days of Noah. The other part of Genesis chapter 9 that's significant for us begins in verse 18. "Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. We came from those three." So from those three, all the ethnic groups, all the nations, all the languages, everything came through Ham, Shem, or Japheth. And of course, a lot more about that next Sunday night. But the whole earth was populated through those three. "And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan..." Notice how he's already mentioned that twice because it has great significance. "Saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside." That was two things he's already done that's wrong. "But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both of their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away and they did not see their father's nakedness." So we have these three sons that through whom the whole world, I mean, everything was going to be dispersed through them. All was going to come through them. Noah, after the flood, begins to be a farmer and he plants a vineyard. Now, there is quite a number of years that takes place between the flood and what happens with Noah here. The reason for that is, why? Well, Ham has to have a son and the son has to grow up. So that's a number of years that takes place in those few verses right there. So during that time, apparently everything was fine. There was bliss and peace and no conflict and happiness and everything. Well then, one way or another, Noah learns how to make alcohol. And he becomes drunk. And what does the drinking lead to? Becoming uncovered. I wish we had time to read a number of places in the Bible that connect those two things. Those two things are connected a lot, drinking and being naked. They're very commonly found, especially in the Old Testament, those two. Of course, the reason for that is alcohol's number one effect on the body is to lower inhibitions. So by doing that, it affects the parts of your brain that controls your inhibitions. So the more you drink, the less inhibited you are. So no wonder, what did Noah do? Takes his clothes off. Why? Because his inhibitions are let down. And of course, that is, you know, seeing another person's nakedness forms a lot of the Old Testament. Leviticus chapter 18, most of that chapter is about how you're not supposed to see the nakedness of. And then there's a whole list beginning about verse 3, going all the way down to about verse 18 or 19 or 20, about all the different people, you know, you're not supposed to see your father or your mother or your aunt or uncle or sister, and just on and on and on. But I think the significant part is how those two things are connected often in the Bible. Again, because of what alcohol does to you. So Noah, we might say, eased up, wasn't careful. And so what did he do? He became drunk with wine, and that, of course, was his downfall. So what did Ham do? Well, saw the nakedness of his father. But then, even worse than that, what did he do? He says, hey, Shem, hey, Japheth, come here, I want to show you something. Which was even worse than seeing the nakedness of his father. But Shem and Japheth, being the right kind of people, did what? They went to great lengths not to. So they put this garment between their shoulders and they back up so they can't see their father, and then put that on the father so he's no longer naked. Well, what happens though? So in verse 24, Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. How did he know that? Well, the Bible doesn't say how he knew that. Because he was asleep and partially at least drunk. So how did he know that? Don't know. Maybe God told him. But anyway, when he woke up, he knew. So notice what he says. Then he said, cursed be Canaan. He did not say, cursed be Ham. He said, cursed be Canaan. Some people think that Canaan was also a part of this, but it doesn't say he was. But Canaan, of course, is one of Ham's sons. Something we'll talk about, Lord willing, next Sunday night. But Canaan, God already knew what kind of person Canaan was going to be. Canaan was going to be perverse. He was going to be, you know, a wicked, evil person. And so Canaan was cursed. And when we look at, of course, the land of Canaan, named after Canaan, and we look, again, Leviticus chapter 18, verses 1 through 3 of that chapter, talk about the Canaanites and how wicked and evil they were. And so those people, those descendants of Canaan that dwelled in that land, were known as an immoral, wicked, evil people. So he says, Canaan, you're cursed, and you're going to be a servant of servants. And he shall be that to his brethren. Now he says, verse 26, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. And may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. And so there's blessings, and then there's curses. Ham, through his son Canaan, will be cursed. But Shem and Japheth are both blessed. Shem, of course, is the one through whom the nation of Israel came through, and the Messiah. So Jesus Christ himself was born through the line of Shem. But Japheth would be, as hopefully we'll talk next week, Japheth is the ones that ended up populating, you know, North America, Europe, those type of places. So beginning in Acts chapter 10 and on, it was the descendants of Japheth that were the ones that primarily were ones that responded to the gospel. And of course, they ended up being blessed. So there is much in those verses there There's so much in those verses that we can just kind of gloss over if we don't dig into them and see what all they teach. And then it ends and says, and Noah lived after the flood 350 years, so all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Just like all the other patriarchs. That's how it ends on all the patriarchs. Lived so many years, and he died. And he died. One thing that the Bible says Jesus Christ did is that all the descendants of Ham, all the descendants of Shem, all the descendants of Japheth, Jew or Gentile, slave or free, can be what? They can be saved. Colossians chapter 3, verse 11. Regardless of one's nationality, regardless of anyone's ethnicity, regardless of someone's origin, through Jesus Christ, they can all be saved. And of course, that's the good news of the Bible. That's the good news of the entire Bible from Genesis to Revelation, is that all can come to Christ for salvation, regardless through whom they were descended. And that, of course, is the importance of taking the gospel to the whole world, as we are told to do in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke. The gospel that's open to all. It is for all. And it's available, salvation is, at any time. And so as David leads us in this song, we encourage you, if you need to respond, to do that. Let's stand and sing this song.